Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Such a great day to have a short session because we have a triple header. Yes, we have the Shabbat HaChodesh, which is a Shabbat, one of the great memorial Shabbats throughout the year. We're commemorating something new going on, and one of the things that we're commemorating is the beginning of months. So we'll be hitting that here when we get into the Passover season, but it's one that starts off with the first month, the month of Aviv, and a lot of the things that happen in the first month and continue on down through the rest of the year. So some of the things that we'll be covering as we get forward with this. So first, let's kick it off with a little prayer. Father, we thank you so much for giving us your words of Torah. We thank you for giving us your Son, the Messiah. And we thank you for giving us your Spirit to help us to remember, help us to understand, and take the things that you've taught us and put them into life. Father, we thank you for these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen. I always like to take a look at the big picture of things as to where we're going, why we're going, and what we're going to end up with when we get there. So some of the questions we're going to be looking at as we get going are, we got in this section some pretty baffling things. This is going to be a brief look at them. We've looked at them in years past, and if you want to take a look at them again, we do have those available for over a number of years. But one of the perplexing things is, you know, why do you have these instructions for purifying childbirth? You know, together with those about purifying a leper, or you could say the walking dead. What, you got the beginning of life, and you got someone who's walking dead, treated almost as if they are not alive at all, but then brought back to life. And also, why do you have this miracle of birth needing to have a sin offering? And, you know, what is it about baby girls that then doubles the exclusionary period from the tabernacle? And why is there such this elaborate ritual that's in there? It's going to be mentioned as we actually get into the next part. It's kind of a difficult one when you have a leap year like this, because they end up splitting this section, because actually Leviticus 12, 13, 14, and 15 are really kind of a package together, because here this week you're kind of left hanging. Okay, you've diagnosed the walking dead, and you know, what then do you do about them? Well, that's what chapter 14 goes into. And then we'll also be rounding this out with, you know, how this rebirth of the leper is really similar to the, you could say, resurrection of Israel from the house of bondage, which is what we celebrate when we go around through Passover time. So, amazingly enough, what we're looking at today really does coincide well with what we'll be celebrating here at the mid part of this first month, with Pesach and unleavened bread, and moving forward into Shavuot or Pentecost. So those are some of the big topics we're going to be looking at here briefly today. So a bit of an overview of what this section is with Leviticus 12, 13, 14, and 15. Leviticus 12 is really about redeeming the mother and her newborn, and then you get the perplexing thing of a boy this period, and for a girl, double that period. Then Leviticus 13, you've got the diagnosing of the metzorah, or it's commonly translated as leper, but we'll be looking specifically more into what this metzorah is, because it can be a person, a place, or a thing, you know, going back to the ugly, nasty days of nouns. And Leviticus 14 is where you then get the redeeming of the metzorah. So you're not just leaving this person, you know, lurking about, actually lurking about on the fringes of society, literally, but you have a way to bring that person back in. And Leviticus 15 is about the redeeming of the tzav and the tzavah. And one of those things you see in the, with the tzav and tzavah is that you have, you could say, you have a loss. This is all about, you could say, a loss of something. And interestingly enough, here when you're talking about paradise lost, paradise regained, which is, you could say, the whole scope of what the testimony of the Lord is there from the beginning part of Bereshit all the way down through Revelation with the dwelling place of man, the place of God is with man and amongst men. We celebrate that each Sukkot. But then you also see that again with the redemption of Yisrael. Israel goes down into bondage, foretold that it was going to happen. Remember when we were back in Bereshit in Genesis, chapter 12 through 15, and this prophecy then to Abraham that's saying, hey, this bondage is going to come. It's going to happen. But I'm going to bring them back up out of it. So that should be kind of sounding a little bit familiar because remember another prophecy that was given to this much later on to Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah. And he said, hey, 70 years and they're going to bring you back up again. And as the prophet Ezekiel is saying, it's like resurrecting dead dry bones. So you see this recurring theme of resurrection, rebirth, what seemed like the walking dead of Israel in exile, Israel in Mitzrayim, would be brought back, brought from what you thought was the total brink of destruction, of nothingness. So that's kind of the arc of where 12 through 15 in Leviticus go. So now going down and going under the hood a little bit. These are some of the terms we're going to be hitting not only here, but also as we continue on through Vayikra Leviticus. These are terms that will be seen on a regular basis. We started out looking at in Leviticus chapter 1, talking about the Korban. And then we are also delving heavily into Kodesh for holiness and for Tahor and Tameh we'll be looking at today for clean and unclean, respectively. And today, especially, we'll be looking at the Tzatzarat, which is translated for leprosy, and the Hametzora, or, you know, the one where the Tzatzarat is landed upon, or the thing, or the place that it's landed upon. So, those are the generally the terms we're going to be looking at here. So, starting out first with Kodesh, just a little refresher with Kodesh. Kodesh does not mean perfect. Kodesh means that which is apart or separate. So, thus, that's always a key thing to keep in the back of your head because, you know, you might think, oh, a holy people. Does that mean the perfect people? They are, nothing is ever wrong with them. They're just totally fantastic. No, that means that God has said, I am setting you apart. I am, you know, it's used in a different form and we use a different English word with it called sanctify, but it's talking about the same thing. I am the one who sanctifies you. So when you look at the original the original use of this term for kad or kadash, it means to cut. So something that's been cut off. Interesting, because what we heard that term also used and kind of translated as such later on about being cut off from the people. So very interestingly, you have a people who are cut off for God. And then from those people that have been cut off for God, then you have those who are cut off from those who are cut off. So you get chop, 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 chop. So one of those things that you should be getting the picture of with this, you know, slicing and further slicing here is what? Selection. Selection. And as you can see, as we continue on through Vayikra and even in what we're talking about here today, this selection is also about refinement. So selection, refinement. All you might say also called out and what? A people who are called out and
set apart
and
sanctified
and redeemed. They are set apart and get the waltz right in. Well, what then are they then? Set apart and chosen. So, yes, you're set apart, but then from that set apart, then it's like, okay, well, where is this going to develop? And how will it be developed over time? So that's where you could sort of keep in the back of your mind about Kodesh, meaning perfect. That's not what's being communicated. So one of the things you see in there that we have with our blessing over when we talk about and we have the hand washing, and right after that we have this particular blessing. And a key part of that that we should always remember is the one who, Kadashenu, who sanctifies you. Not, oh, how lovely we are. Look, he is the one who sets us apart, who makes us holy.
Does that have a relationship to what the master said when he said, many are called, but few are chosen?
Exactly.
Would the words be the same? Would you say
the words be the same? Now, that's an interesting question. Well, because then you'd have to kind of look to see if they trace back through in the Septuagint. Now, that's an interesting question. I have to look into that one. If you're using similar words there in the Greek and they follow back through to the Septuagint and into the Hebrew. That's a good question. Yes.
Mainstream Christians, that those words were used that way when the Messiah said it.
About, oh, then you get into one of those.
By the chosen people, many are chosen, but fewer, many are called, but few are chosen.
Yes.
That was a warning, after all.
Yes, exactly. That is a key warning. And we've seen these in some previous studies we've gone through so far about what people who were called out. We saw that when we were going through Exodus, there was a whole bunch of people called out, but then you had rebellions that happened. We saw that particularly recently when we were going through the section on the golden calf.
So is it choosing on you or on God?
Choosing on you or on God. So what do you mean by that?
Well, it's if many are called and few are chosen.
Mm-hmm.
God called them all out of Egypt.
Right.
Okay, so to me, the choice would be that the people made the choice not to be chosen.
Yes, and that's specifically when we go through the gospel that Yochanan brings forward, and Messiah brings it out, and he says, yeah, you know, they all ate the same bread. They were under the same cloud out there in the desert, but what happened? They walked away, and their bodies, they fell in the desert during the 40 years.
A lot of them walked away.
Yes, they ate the same spiritual bread. They were drinking the same spiritual water, but it's like, do you know where it's coming from? And that's a key word, Kadashenu. That's a key phrase, because he is the one who makes us holy. We don't set ourselves aside because of this or that or the other. We do things because he said, this is what set apart people do. But those things in and of themselves, we've gone through the prophets and looked at how they railed against the things that the Lord commanded. What, just because the Lord was done with them now? No, because people were trying to use them as lucky charms. They even tried to use the Ark of the Covenant. We saw that scene there where they were trying to use that as a lucky charm.
Imagine being destructive.
Magically destructive. Yes. Woo. Yeah. Don't touchy. So the other thing we've been looking at since the beginning of Yikra is Korban. And another thing that we always should be keeping in mind, just like with Kodesh is that which is set apart. The Korban is that which approaches. It means to draw near. So we've been looking at with the Mishkan, the tabernacle, as that is where we want our destination to be. So how do we get there? The Korban is how we get there. And a little hint, that's a little bit about what we're looking at today with these strange things related to new mothers and lepers, the Metzorah. So one of the things that we see with Korban is the thing that approaches. But the other thing that we should be noticing here is that the Korban in and of itself does not remove sin. We've seen that with the prophets. The prophets make that exactly clear, that, hey, and actually, we just saw that in our last passage when we saw it with Nadab and Abihu. What they were bringing was not a magic charm. What was wrong with it? Yes, not the right type, not the right heart. That's the heart of the matter, is how you are approaching that. And that's something that we see as we move along through this today, is where is your heart at? And it comes into focus, especially with the Metzorah. Another vocab term here, especially today, with is Tahor. And with Tahor, it's translated usually as clean, but one of the things is that you could take of it is that the Tahor does not block entry. So you're saying that with your Korban, you bring it in, and if it is Tahor and things go well, it's heading towards the presence of God. So that should be the lesson then. This is one of those things that is fit to approach, might be another way to put the term clean, that which is fit to approach. So, one of the things that we can also see from this is that, and one of the things you could see about the discussion of the Metzorah is all the ways that things can go the other way to become unfit to approach. And the lesson there is that, you know, that just because something is clean does not mean that it always stays that way. And that's one of those things about guarding yourselves, guarding what you're doing. So on to the next one of Tameh. Now, one of the things that will especially come into focus with our first part of the look here today, we're looking at the new mothers, the newborns, that should be bringing into pretty clear focus that Tameh, translated as unclean or unfit to approach, does not mean evil, you know, wicked, those sorts of things. Because that's one of the key questions that we started out our discussion with. Well, why would you then start condemning new mothers, new children? What did they do? So one of those things that we look on in this fit to approach, unfit to approach, is what is the lesson of the Mishkan? Mishkan, as we've talked about in a number of sessions previously to this, the Mishkan is to tell us, hey, that is the presence of whom? The creator of heaven and earth. In other words, life. That's the, you could say, the capital of life is there. And that is something that should be conveyed, that the things that are to be communicated in the whole bit of everything that goes on inside the tabernacle is that is what brings life. And that is the beachhead for the kingdom of life. So the other side of that is, well, outside of that is what? The kingdom of death, the kingdom of things that are headed down, headed away from it. And that's actually, you know, when you talk about what is the greater message you can have people in the secular world, that is one of the great testimonies that we have, like the Apostle Paul brings out, that we can see the great power of God in the things that are made. And one of those things that's marvelous is that life fights decay. Eventually, in this world that we're in, it succumbs to decay, but it fights against it. It is a bizarre thing, because life is rebuilding, restructuring, repairing, all these things to take care of the things that drag towards death. So if you're looking just as the witness out there, wow, the things that are bringing life, the source of life is fighting against death. Yes, death is in the world, but there is something there that is designed to fight against death, decay, this and that and the other. So thus you've got a great bit that you have the embassy, the beachhead of life, in the midst and encircled about by the kingdom of death. And that when we go to the end of the book, no matter if you're talking about in the prophets or in the book of Revelation, you see the end of the story is what? The kingdom of death wins, right?
No,
it doesn't. The kingdom of death does not win. In fact, one of the things that you see a great, you could say a prophecy, is that death is swallowed up by life. Death is swallowed up by life. That is a big lesson of Sharia today, is death is swallowed up by life. So that's a bit there about Tomei, just closing out with this idea of Tomei starting with this unfit to approach, really started with the Garden of Eden. And we saw that. What was one of the first reactions? The whole thing about unclothed and clothed is a discussion in and of itself, but what was the reaction when the first pair realized that they were totally exposed before the Lord, that nothing was hidden, and they were hiding? That rebelliousness caused a rift in there. And the rift has just gotten wider and wider and wider and wider as the centuries and the eons have rolled on. So, now to the kind of thorny question of, well, why is this new mother, Tomei, what did she do? What did the babies do about this? So, again, there was kind of skipping across like a rock across the top of a pond on this. But one of the things to look at, and we've just mentioned it, looking back to the garden, it should draw your attention there. Because, yeah, we've seen something like this before. Because one of the things that we could say medically, anatomically, however you want to go on about the differences between bearing male children, bearing female children, and the different things that happen to the body of the mother as a result of that, and after that, it's like, okay, there is effects that last for quite a while afterward. So when you're talking about these in time periods where you have a time where there is a lot of stuff going on that you renders one unfit to approach, you're like, well, that should get you thinking again. How did it end up this way? How did it end up this way? Well, one of the things you go back is you see in Genesis chapter 3 and in verse 16 about one of those things that lingers on is greatly multiplying the pain of childbirth. So, you know, there are a number of secular folk that will just say, well, that's just happened because our brains got too big. So that's the reason why it caused to be the problem. But that should be kind of ringing somewhat hollow, because if you look out there in the animal kingdom, you also see, you know, what, big-headed creatures. Big-headed creatures. So, should be telling you, hey, something is a little bit amiss. Something is a little bit different with the, you could say, the human condition on this. And should be hearkening you back to, well, where did this come from? David, do you have a comment back there? Okay. I just thought you looked quite quizzical, so I thought, hey, I should just ask if you had a question.
I don't.
Okay. I'll just preemptively ask you, David, do you have a question? But one of the things as we look at this, looking back to the beginning, is that with the beginning was a march toward death. And we see that in Genesis chapter 2 and in chapter 3, that this recurring phrase there, you know, in dying you will die, various ways that it's translated across there with the beginning progression toward death, death fully wrapping into and taking over life at that particular point in time. But one of those things that we get in there is a not-so-modern lie. We can live forever. We can live forever. In the passage that we have there from Genesis chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, the serpent said to the woman, "You surely will not die, for God knows that in the day that you eat from it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." I said this is a... this is a not-so-modern lie. How do you see this today? Okay, you can say the teaching there of dying and going to heaven. But one of those things that you see this brought forward today is, well, does God really know everything? Yeah, it's just because, you know, the... you know, the ends of the telomeres on our genetics are unraveling. And that's because that's the reason why we die. You know, it's just because of this and that. We just bolt on this and we can download our consciousness and upload it into a new body and continue on, or upload it into a computer and live on, you know, into eternity as some sort of digital self and continue on and on and on that way. So, this old lie of, did God really say, is that really true that you really just can't live on and on and on as you would want to? Yes.
How about you just keep on sinning and just tell God you're sorry and you'll get to live forever?
Keep on sinning and, you know, keep doing the same thing over and over again. Yeah, well, I mean, you would then say, okay, well, then what happened to Adam and Eve was just totally uncalled for, because if the world is as a good portion of the planet has postulated over thousands of years, where you have the dark forces and you have the white forces, and they must balance each other through life, and you have to have the dark to match the white and kind of balance them together so things even out. You've got to have a little gray, a little here, a little there, a little. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you might have heard that phrase before in the prophets, because when you get that idea that you can just mix in a little bit of darkness in there, and you even have some teachings that saying, well, people wouldn't like to live in a place where there is no evil, there is no death, and this and that. It'd be too boring. It'd be too boring. Not exciting enough. Yes?
Apparently Eve agrees with that philosophy.
Oh, things are just too boring. Ah, let's spice things up a little bit. Yes. Yeah. Oh. Oh boy. What is that? I think it's someone here with the tar and feathering committee. Yes. Oh, look out. But that question there of where did this lie start and where is it progressing? It's been around for a long time, and it just keeps getting a nice new wrapping on, a nice new bow on it, gets repackaged a different way to say, well, you know, you really don't die. You really, the way things are will continue on as they are. You can keep on living the same way of life. You don't have to change. You don't have to go around this or that. It's very interesting. I think I got a little insight on that from, you know, a prophet that was actually a number of prophets. Is one of the things that the Messiah talked about when he was saying during the time of the flood, they were eating and drinking. Hey, everything is going to go on as it is. Nothing's going to change. The world will continue on. Funny thing how, you know, it was depicted at the time of Noah as being, you know, their violence was only increasing, but people going on, hey, this is just the way it is, you know, as you're sitting there in your nice little frog hot tub as the temperature keeps getting hotter and hotter and hotter, you just don't realize where things have gone, except for what? The outside perspective for how bad things have gone. Because otherwise, you know, you could just be like Lot and just keep moving closer, moving closer, moving closer, moving closer to the seat of, you could say, the capital of things that are going the other way, away from God. Yes.
It's also kind of interesting how, you know, the first great sin of the Bible is eating that which God said not to eat. And here we look at the society today, and there's so many that deny or make excuses or find scripture out of context to support eating whatever they choose and denying his Leviticus food instructions.
Yeah, and it is interesting you bring that up. It was just in the passage we went through last week. Well, quite an interesting sort of idea on this of, well, why is it as it is? Why is it specified as it is? Don't eat this, don't eat that. Don't eat this, don't eat that. Well, we happen to be going into another period like that. It's called what? Matzot. Matzot is a form of that. It's only temporary, but it is a form of that. But you could say, what is matzot? Matzot is a fast of a sort. It is a fast where you are not eating a certain category of stuff. Well, the things that are tahor and tameh in the food category, that's permanent. For the different fast days like Yom Kippur, that is one day, everything across the board. So when you look at it in a sense that the tahor and tameh in the realm of food is a fast, when you think of it as a fast and not some sort of categorical distinctions of healthfulness, as some people have looked at it, you know, you'll, in a sense, run yourself in circles if you try to totally base tahor and tameh on the things that are only health-related. I mean, when you look at the idea of, you know, the metzora of things and places like houses and such, you might say, okay, you're starting to get into the public health realm. But for some things, it is just a message. Pay attention to the message. For example, when you have the metzorah, just happens to be in a place, and then does what? It's like makes a it's like a hazmat bomb that just goes off inside of a residence. Well, is that a public health hazard? Could be questionable. But when you look at it from the standpoint of what is it actually teaching, and we'll be getting to that in just a second here. Yes?
I remember Messiah, of course, called Satan a murderer from the beginning and a liar. But, you know, one of the things that I've always thought was the most horrible thing about this, really, is that we never had to learn anything about evil. If we hadn't tried to, he wanted them to worship him, so he was trying to be like God, really. And Eve was fooled, it says, but he only gave us good. And then the creation, he said, it is. He looked and it was good.
But we had to learn about evil, and that's what that seems like to me, you know. Choose between these two. Would you like to live and only learn about good, or would you like to learn about evil also?
Yes.
Like you said, people think, well, it'll be boring. How can it be boring?
Yeah, well...
But we didn't need to learn. He gave us good, and we didn't need to know anything about evil.
Yeah. I mean, do you have to wallow in it to realize that it makes you dirty? And... Yes.
So.
Well, and that's one thing we looked on our previous occasion when looking through the Apostle Yaakov or James there in chapter 1, and he's talking about, you know, consider it pure joy when you go through trials of many kinds. So we're going through here soon the memorial of Pesach, of Passover, and that is delivery from the house of bondage. Historical event. We've just seen here recently documentaries that talk about, yeah, it's becoming more clear every day. Yes, you're talking about a historical event. And then we've also talked in previous years about how this is also a personal event, our own personal Passover, where we came out of our own house of bondage into the land of freedom and move on from there. So that we can look on that. But if we then are in our time or sojourning in the wilderness, do we say, wow, you know, I just want to live in a place that is totally, totally stress-free, no problems, nothing ever comes to worry me, this or that or the other. Why does this stuff just keep happening to me all over again? This happens, that happens. Why does it just keep happening? Consider it pure joy when you face trials of many kinds. So thus, you know, if we just happen to be in the midst of something, get caught in something, and wondering why is this happening to us, number one, always a good thing to check, are you headed off the path? And, you know, if you're not headed off the path, then time to check, well, what can I learn? And hopefully in both questions, you're also doing a bunch of reflection in here. What can I learn from this situation and move forward with it? So, speaking of things we can learn, Tzatzarat, the Nega Hatzatzarat is what's called the mark of leprosy. And mark, it's kind of interesting, mark or sign, because Naga is something we encounter during the time of the plagues for the 10th plague. The 10th plague is called a Naga, or a plague, the plague on the firstborn, this mark on the firstborn. So when he's talking about placed a mark on somebody, you know, when you look at, if you do kind of word studies on the various Hebrew words that are used for plague, you know, in the Torah, in those two places with the 10th plague and here in this case about the instructions of the Metzorah, this is where you encounter this term of a sign. But what then are we to learn about it? We encountered in times past, and you got some references here of some people. If you want to look them up there on Numbers 12, you got the accounts of Miriam and Aharon. In 2 Chronicles 26, you have King Uzziah. And 2 Kings chapter 5, you have Elisha's aide, Gehazi. Remember, it was kind of the very interesting account in times past. We've delved into the details of, you know, you've got Naaman, the foreign general, foreign captain, commander from Aram. And you know, you notice in this passage was talking about that they were sending bands in to the Aram was sending bands in to kidnap people from Israel, and one of the kidnappees was this girl, and the one who, you know the story there, turned him toward the prophet, and in the process of that, you're noticing it. And actually, from this encounter is where you get this idea of the walking dead that kind of comes through with the Metzorah, because when the message comes through that Naaman's wanting to come through and see this prophet, the king, the little puppet king at the time, was like, ah, what am I supposed to do? You know, do I have power over life and death? Can I, you know, make people alive, make them dead? Is that within my power? So you get that picture there that the Metzorah is like already considered a corpse. And, you know, the Tzatzarot also showing up on mold and mildew and in the houses and the building material of it. But on to the lessons of the Metzorah. And this comes courtesy from Daniel a couple years ago, but it's such a cool event when you look back at these stories that one of these things that you'll see is that they, each of them, Gehazi, Uzziah, and Miriam, were profaning God's name, making it common in the eyes of someone else. So we were going here recently talking about the Ten Commandments, and a part of that is do not take the name of the Lord and make it common, to make it ordinary. A part of what's going on, at least in the spiritual condition of these people, a common thread is that they were taking the status of the Lord and bringing it lower. And one of the things that has been associated with the condition called Tzatzarat is associated with Lashon Hara, or the bad tongue, the evil tongue. There are a couple places where you see it sort of used in talking about fleeing from the tongue that speaks evil there in Psalm 34:14. But something we'll be getting to soon is in Leviticus 19, the holiness chapter, the Kadosh chapter, about how to be Kodesh, how to be set apart and how set apart people are to live. And in verse 16 there, you'll notice there, if you remember correctly, verse 18 is where we find the passage of the second greatest commandment, you know, love the Lord, love your neighbor as yourself. So one of the things that comes up there a little bit earlier, just a few verses earlier, is it's talking about do not hold a grudge, do not seek for the life of your neighbor. And a part of that seeking for the life is to speak badly, to speak badly about them. So one of the things that we've talked about in previous times is that the difference between the Lashon Hara and the, with another term that's called Motzi Shem Ra, which is Motzi, remember, you know, brings forth bread from the earth, Motzi Lechem Min Haaretz. So Motzi Shem Ra, so to bring forth name that's bad. So that's what you would call defamation. So to create a bad reputation. So with Lashon Hara is, you could say, seen to be things that are true. You're speaking truth, but to destroy. The Motzi Shem Ra, what that is we call it fake news. It's defamation, destroying someone with absolutely false report. Yes, and all kinds of other things that have happened down through time. So, one of the things that we could say, well, what is Lashon Hara? Lashon Hara is, it's true information, but it's also something that's, you know, contrary to the love chapter. And just some notes here from 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 4 through 8, and then verse 9. Love is patient, love is kind, it is not jealous, does not brag, it is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account the wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Then skipping down to verse 9. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when perfect comes, the partial will be done away. And oftentimes we think of that as, whoa, that's just, we'll know things at the coming of the Lord's kingdom. What does this verse 9 also tell you? You don't know the whole story, so don't spread it. You don't know what's going on, so why do you spread what you think is going on? Even if you know what's going on, just don't spread it. So when we look in here, this is one guy about 100 years ago or so, the Chofetz Chaim is a treatise on Lashon Hara. It's like it got 31, you could say, components of what he looked at as being components of Lashon Hara. But some of the key components is buckets, you might say, of what Lashon Hara is, with derogatory information, stuff that drags you down. So, you know, describing a person's negative characteristics. Remember that back there in 1 Corinthians? Doesn't delight in unrighteousness? You know, delight in someone's unrighteousness, you could put it another way. Doesn't spread potentially harmful information, stuff that's embarrassing, garnering ill will. In other words, making other people look down upon this person because of what you share about them. But some other things that this brings forward that's also kind of helpful, and there's a number of references for this, but helping a person in question, that's not something that it is. Discussing something with a trustworthy person, something that is not going to then spread it around. On what to do about a situation, how to correct it. Helping a victim, prevent victimization, resolving a major dispute, or peacemaking. But one of these things you notice here in this list is that what is the, you could say, the full weight of what is happening with your tongue and what it's doing. To pay attention to what it is that's coming out of your mouth, because you may think that things are absolutely harmless and what you're doing is just conveying information that people need to know. But think about the downstream effects. You know, the rabbis always have this illustration of the, you know, bag full of feathers or the pillow full of feathers and releasing it and trying to get them all back again after they blow into the wind. Well, you just never know what it is that's going to happen. That's why I show you that verse 9 there in 1 Corinthians 13 is you see things darkly. You don't know where things are going to go when you start talking about other people. So always think again, think a third time as you know, share information that could take someone down a little peg in someone else's eyes. So, as we get now looking into the Pesach season, yes.
Just one last thought on what you were saying. I mean, it's something we're all guilty of, and
yes,
even, you know, as we strive to be as righteously as we can, I mean, we even fall victim to that, you know, without the intention. When somebody comes up to us and they said, "Hey, did you hear about so-and-so? Or did you hear what happened to you?" And, you know, the next thing you know, we're in this conversation, and then it just grows from there. And it's just something I think each and every one of us, myself included, you know, we need to constantly think about what we're taking place in and how to end this and move out smoothly and stop it on both ends.
Yeah. Yes.
That's funny. It brings another. So my wife had asked me earlier today regarding a similar topic. So I'm sure all of you have run across this many, many times in your lives. Someone says, somebody else, who it is, "Oh, don't forget to pray for person A," who the person A is. "Oh, why?" Oops. You know how hard that is? What's wrong with person A? Are you praying for them? Well, what's going on? That's really hard. Because I know myself, personally speaking, if someone says, "Go pray for person A," if I have no clue what's going on with person A, I will forget to pray for them. I will. Because there's no story There's no explanation of what am I praying for, what's going on. By tomorrow, I will have forgotten I was supposed to pray for them. And she brought this to me, so, okay, so at what threshold is it required? Do I need enough information to remember to pray for them? Or I've got too much information to where, up, now it beyond what I needed to know. That's a really difficult line to walk. And honestly, I'll tell you the truth, I break the line not knowing it all the time. Because with me, my personal head, if I don't have enough story to remember, to recall, just saying, pray for so-and-so, they're having a hard marriage, for example, or a hard this or that, I will forget within an hour. And the whole week will go by, or a month, or a year, and I will have forgotten to pray for them. Because it wasn't enough information for me to remember to do it. But if I get a long, drawn-out, half-hour-long story of stuff I didn't need to know, well, now I brought that person lower in my own eyes, and now they've slandered them. It's a difficult line to walk, both in the receiving, the hearing of it, as well as through, oh, so-and-so asked for prayers, and I'm trying to tell, oh, what, and they, well, why? What's going on with the person? And it's a hard place to be. I told her, I don't have a good answer. Because every individual, every story is unique. Every prayer request is unique in and of its own. It's hard to know what point is I, oh, that's too much information, or no, I need more because I'm going to forget otherwise by tomorrow.
I have an easy way to remember. If someone approaches you and says, I need prayer, if I come up to you and say, I need prayer, and you say, why? And I tell you maybe one or two sentences. Instead of waiting until that evening to do it in your prayer closet, pray with that person who's asking for the prayer, whether they're asking for themselves or whether they're asking on behalf of somebody else. Just say, well, maybe we should just pray right now. Let's just pray right now. And then that way, since you've said the prayer, you'll remember also to do it later on. Because if I say to you, I need you to pray for X, and you and I immediately right there pray for it, then you will remember later on that evening, yeah, I prayed with Tammy about this earlier today. I want to pray about it again in my private prayer closet.
That may work. Sure.
I'd just like to add that God knows what you need way before you ever ask for it. And so when somebody says, I need prayer, you don't need to remember or forget. You can just right there in your own head, you can, if you don't want to pray out loud, you can even ask God right there, Father, I don't know what they need, but you do. So I'm asking on their behalf that you're there with them. I do it all the time up on Facebook. People ask for prayers. They don't describe to me what they need. They just say I'm in trouble. I need prayer. I give them a prayer right there. I write it out and I send it to them right there. I just tell them, Father, you know their need, and I'm asking you to intervene in their life for them.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting point because I have a friend who is very good at, you could say, defanging Lashon Hara, or you could say removing the tongue by just doing that, by saying, oh, we really need to pray about this, and then just going right into prayer at that point, because it's like you could just tell the whole mood has changed to, instead of dishing on somebody, it's like, okay, you know, do we really want to take this to anyone where it really actually matters? So that kind of helps, I've seen, change the whole frame of the discussion. So, but again, it gets into that thing of, wow, be careful about how much actually comes out. So, yes.
In generally speaking, when if somebody comes to ask for prayer, it's one thing. But generally speaking, I usually try to apply the philosophy which Messiah had given. You know, the friend who pounded on the door at midnight asking for bread, because it's that persistence. That's everybody's different. I get that. That's how I pray for people, is it's a persistent thing until I've exhausted my memory of praying for them. And I'll be honest with you, this is how I am. I usually pray at night when I'm on my bed, ready for sleep. Go through all the people, all the lists, all the different names and such, and go through them. Out loud with my wife, we just pray about each person that I remember to pray for. And that's usually when I make my prayers. I know each person is different. We all have our own methodologies. So that happens to be mine. I usually don't write them down, so I usually forget them. Unless she remembers so-and-so or this person, that person. And it is difficult at times. And praying at the moment in time, if the story for my own person, if the story is, impactful enough to me to remember that I prayed then, I might remember later on that night, as Tammy says, I might remember it later on. I may not, because I know me very, very well. I have a very bad memory when it comes to certain things. So I totally get that each person has their own methodology to deal with this threshold of too much information or not enough. And I want to just bring it up today that remember that because we're all different, be aware of that. And sharing too much could be a serious problem. And so things may be shared with you that were not intended for anybody else to know, but they're shared with you for you to know. And it's really important on each individual human to remember that that affects everybody's viewpoint of the person being spoken about or prayed for, regardless of how great or how difficult the situation is for that individual. They may be in a great position, and you're praying for them because you're saying, hey, God, great, this person, they did great, doing a great job, blah, blah, blah. That's fine and all, but be aware that even that can be degrading at times. It's just a hard thing to threshold to line or line to draw. But I have also tried to remember, on the receiving end, when you're hearing somebody saying, pray for me for this reason, or pray for so-and-so, they ask for prayer because of this reason, to remember to block out the conversation. To shut off when it says, hey, I've gotten too much information, and tell a person, that's enough. That's enough. I don't need any more. That's good enough.
All right. Well, let's close things out here with just a little reminder going forward. This is something that the sage Rambam had seen quite a long time ago. It's an interesting little idea that seen some connections between the cleansing ritual for the Matzorah, the leper, and some things during the Pesach, you know, because some of the emblems of the Matzorah is you have the cedar wood, then you have the hyssop, and then you've got also the two birds, and then you've got this scarlet string, and you're just kind of like making this bundle, and it really seems odd. And, you know, you kill one bird and drain out, and you let the other bird go free, and you're supposed to drain the blood out over running water, and it just seems to be quite weird. But then, you know, and you start connecting some of the pieces together, and perhaps there is a bit of a parallel in the sense that you have cedar wood dipped in blood, the mezuzah or the doorpost during the Pesach passing that is painted with the blood of the Pesach, in both cases with the hyssop or the baptizo or dipped into the blood and used. Then you also, this is what I thought was kind of interesting. You have the Metzorah, the leper, is told during these periods of inspection to be staying outside of the congregation for 7 days. And then we were talking earlier about the fast of matzah, the fast from anything that has the corruption or the fermenting of the wheat going on there at that particular time period. So blood sprinkled on the moving water, that's maybe a little bit stretched there about the blood of the Mitzrayim army into the sea. One bird killed, firstborn of Mitzrayim killed. One of those things when we go through and we celebrate the Pesach, that's one of the things that we remember is the death of the firstborn of Mitzrayim, because that was a part of what brought the freedom. And as we kind of look forward and seeing the death of the one and only son, also bringing freedom and deliverance. And the one bird that is freed, you have Israel freed from Mitzrayim, the blood and water collected into a clay pot, and the collecting of the blood from the Pesach. So just an ancient picture saying that, hey, you know, there's something going on here that should be harkening us back to something else that happened that brought freedom, to brought a people back from the dead, went down into another country, into exile. there in Mitzrayim, but then we're brought back up again. We talked earlier about second exile being brought back from the dead, the valley of dry bones, and that being brought back to life again. So closing out here at the beginning of months, one of the things to think about as we start back into the cycle of the Moedim again is that, you know, just like with an artist, you know, having an essential collection or an anthology that says this is their whole statement, you have to kind of look at the whole works of all this to get a picture of who they are. That's one of the things that we can communicate with people, is that instead of just looking at Pesach here and, you know, Yom Kippur there, but look at them as like, what is the entire picture of it? You know, there's they had a picture over here which was made up of other little tiny pictures that showed a bigger picture. And that is what the Moedim show us. These appointments in time show us a scope from beginning to end. And one of the things you can see, kind of framed how much more then is the plan of the Creator showing about what he's doing. And Abib here, the first month, is the time where you're getting the crops in, the return of the crops after winter. So, well, how much more then is this a memorial of the one who started a good work in us will actually bring it forth to completion on the day of Messiah Yeshua. So, talked about our personal Passover. This is the new crop. We see that the picture when we start talking about Bikurim, or first fruits, and then marching on to Shavuot or Pentecost of bringing in the harvest, bringing in the harvest, bringing in the harvest. And, you know, taken together, you've got groups in the fall of deliverance and the progression toward deliverance, the process of deliverance through toward, you know, getting the fuller testimony of the Lord there at the mountain with the Ten Commandments. And then in the fall time, really a season of reunion, the calling back with trumpets, the cleansing, the clearing the deck of everything that's left between God and mankind, and then the dwelling place of God with mankind again, and something that we all look forward to. So again, this is a complete picture of what God is doing, not just some agricultural festivals that just happen to be slapped together in a calendar and, you know, give us more reasons to take time off from work. They're a complete picture of who the Lord is and a testimony, because that is what this is revealed to us, as a testimony.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.